Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of murder, suicide, mental illness, drug and alcohol addiction, and possible sexual crimes against children.
The Murder Sheet is a passion project. We started it due to our mutual interest in creating a true crime podcast rooted in reporting and research, where we could showcase informed discussion and long-form reporting in an audio format. Podcasting has a low barrier to entry, but developing a show that aims to reach a wider audience while maintaining journalistic standards is not easy to do, without backing from a podcast network or a larger media corporation. So we feel solidarity with anyone pursuing true crime projects in a similarly independent manner. That's how we got in touch with Brenton Gicker. He's a registered nurse and an EMT. He's also a writer, a journalist, and the creator behind Out from the Void, a small print publication based in Oregon.
We've read through a few issues and were struck by Brenton's dedication to the cases he covers. Out from the Void does not focus on popular cases that everyone's heard of. It's local. It has sympathy for people living on the margins, people with real struggles that often get overlooked. It tackles tricky topics in a nuanced manner. It's also print, which is a medium both Anya and I have a lot of fondness for. It's crime coverage done right, in our view.
So we're pleased to share our interview with Brenton. We'll talk about a few of the cases he's reported on, his thoughts on true crime, and some of the bigger issues that come into play in many missing persons cases. My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews.
We're The Murder Sheet, and this is
Out from the Void, Missing Persons, Mental Illness, and Musings on True Crime with Brenton Gicker.
Thank you.
us a bit about yourself and how you became interested in the true crime genre.
I'm a registered nurse. Part of what got me interested in this is that I've worked for a local mental health agency for nearly 20 years. And doing that work, I've had a lot of contact with the local homeless population and with local people who struggle with mental illness and addiction. One of the things that this agency that I've worked for, we're a mental health crisis intervention team. And so we respond to calls, social service type calls and 911 calls that involve people having mental health problems and substance abuse problems and so forth. Sometimes we get sent to look for people with the police that have gone missing. Sometimes it's maybe an elderly person has wandered away from a nursing home or that kind of thing, or a person has wandered away from a psychiatric facility, or even just a kid gets separated from their parents at the mall, things like that. And so we sometimes get sent to look for people with the police. You know, and usually these situations kind of get resolved pretty quickly and people are found and everything's okay. But sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes we do have some clients that have gone missing that are still missing. And also there's been a number of times over the years when, maybe somebody has been found dead in the park because they died of hypothermia or something like that. Or there's been cases where somebody has committed suicide. They've thrown themselves in front of a train or jumped off a building or what have you. And the police have contacted us to help identify people. So I know that sounds morbid, but it is sometimes something we get tasked with when the police, need our help figuring out who somebody is. Similarly, we might, there are times when, we might find somebody in the community who's really disoriented or confused or altered in some way, and we don't know who they are, and we take them to the hospital, and then maybe in collaboration with hospital staff, we try to figure out who they are and what's going on with them. So I kind of like developed this interest in that kind of low level sort of investigative work through my, the work I've done with this agency. Another thing that comes to mind for me is that when I was in 2015, when I finished nursing school and I had to go to the local sheriff's office to get my fingerprints taken and fill out some paperwork to get my nursing license. And they had this like wall of posters for missing people. And I thought it was kind of intriguing. And there were some of the people, profiled on this wall of missing people. There was at least one person that I recognized as having been a client who's now been, missing for a long time. But there were other people that, either looked like they could have been clients because they, were struggling with mental illness or what have you. And also people that, looked like, people I could have been friends with at some point. So that got me kind of more interested in looking into, who these people are and what their stories are. I looked at NamUs, the directory of missing people and unidentified people, and I saw on there, that not only were there just some names I recognized, but there were actually like people on there that were listed as missing that I knew weren't missing. So I emailed NamUs a couple of times to say, hey, this person's in jail, or hey, this, or I know this person is deceased, or that kind of thing. I actually saw a woman one day that I was a client, but I saw her in the park and I said, hey, did you know you're listed as like a missing person? And she was like, oh, it was probably my mother. I haven't talked to her in a while. I'll reach out to her, that kind of thing. So it was kind of like, these various things, these people I encountered through my work that and these tasks that we sometimes have that got me just kind of more interested in like who like the local missing people are.
One thing that really resonated with us about your work is that sort of down to earth and realistic and basically like this is how a lot of true crime really is. It's people who might be marginalized by society. It's people where there might be mental health struggles involved. It's not the flashy cases that necessarily, take up a lot of media attention. It's this kind of everyday thing. We try to inject some of that into our work, but that's very much a theme that resonated with us in your work. And I'm curious, talk us through going from that interest and working in that space and then deciding to launch your own small print publication.
I really decided to do something more serious with my interest, I guess, in 2018. And part of what inspired that, I was already learning about these people and, looking at these websites and trying to find out more about some of these people. But there was in 2018, like you might have read about in one of my publications, there was a local kid named Teddy Persedina that was missing for about a month, I think, before he was found deceased in the river. And I don't think there was any foul play. I think it was, if anything, there was probably some negligence on the part of his friends. I think he got really drunk and ended up in the river and drowned. The agency I work for, we made some attempts to find him when he first went missing. And I came in contact with his family. And obviously they were, you know, really upset, you know, really wanted to get to the bottom of what happened. And so I went out, joined a search party looking for Teddy, had some contact with his family, especially his father. I think that event sort of prompted me to take a more serious look at these things. But my original idea was that I would publish I would write a series for the Eugene Weekly, the local weekly kind of alternative newspaper, that I would write a series of articles profiling some of the local missing people. I wrote a few articles for the weekly. I think I've written three articles that were published in the weekly, but the weekly, like a lot of print publications, has kind of struggled, especially during the pandemic. So I decided I would print things in the weekly when I could, but since they weren't really printing like more in-depth stories, and they were kind of it's a good publication, but they've kind of struggled. So I thought it would be a good idea just to print things independently so I could look at cases more in depth and not have to be, you know, dependent on them to print my stories.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's something we've noticed in our work as well, where you have, you know, really solid local journalism, but at the same time, it is struggling, unfortunately. You know, we also feel that independent creators can kind of come in and maybe help fill some gaps, essentially, by doing some of the more long-form, in-depth work that you're talking about.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious, so what has been the reception to the work you've been doing so far? What sort of strategies have you employed to get that work in front of people so that it makes an impact on some of these cases that you're writing about?
The first couple stories I wrote that were published in the weekly, especially the first one, I mean, they were pretty in-depth. I mean, they were like, you know, several thousand word essays, and the weekly doesn't really publish articles that long anymore. Those got a lot of reception, especially the first one. I mean, the weekly said that they, based on the visits to their website and based on how many copies were taken from their distribution sites and stuff, that it was like a popular essay. And, you know, and every time I write something, I get some message from somebody who's like, oh, you know, this person who went missing was my aunt or my friend or that kind of thing. But, you know, honestly, I feel like the interest has kind of waned over time, because I think that these are kind of like depressing topics, and they're sometimes kind of obscure, and it's hard to keep people's attention in a lot of cases. But also, you know, it's been harder to find forum for articles, which again is why I've been, you know, printing them up myself. It's a pretty low key project. I have a friend that owns a printing press in Portland, and so if I publish a zine, you know, maybe there'll be maybe 500 to 1,000 copies that I'll make, and I'll just basically give them away to anybody who I think is interested.
And it's always very important to remember, of course, that these people who go missing, their cases really make an impact on those left behind. And in one of your issues, it was devoted to the story of Judy Parker. And in a follow-up issue, you mentioned that her daughter died young, and you said, I believe the distress caused by her mother's disappearance undoubtedly contributed to her death at the young age of 43. Can you talk about that and about how these awful cases affect the relatives left behind?
Yeah, I mean, like several of the people that I've written about, like with Judy Parker, for example, or Aaron Beth McClary, or Rebecca Bramall, you know, these are all like local women that disappeared and are still missing. In some cases, I think if you can pretty accurately theorize about what happened, but in other cases, it's more mysterious. But in all these cases, I mean, like nothing has been written about these people, which to me, I just think is crazy. I mean, these people, like these were like local women that just vanished off the face of the earth. And, you know, and it's possible maybe the police know more than they're letting on, or but there's, you know, no information about them. And, you know, having contacted the families of these women, I mean, who in some cases, I mean, Judy Parker, you know, she's been missing for 6 years, but some of these other women have been, you know, missing for, you know, a decade or more. some of these families are really fractured as a result of what happened. And maybe they have guilt about their final interactions with somebody, or a lot of lingering trauma from that. You know, in some cases, like, yeah, like you talk to some family and you're like, wow, like, I mean, you, the police might have told you, okay, we're looking into it, and then just nothing happened. And then decades later, I mean, there's still no answers. And obviously that takes a toll on people. And like within the case of Judy Parker's daughter, yeah, I think it took a tremendous toll on her. And I think, you know, of course she was struggling with this, like, okay, well, my mother has mental illness. I want to respect her rights, but I also don't think she's really able to care for herself. But Oregon has a really high bar for getting people committed for psychiatric reasons. So she's, I know, it was the struggle for her, you know, trying to balance, well, like, you know, wanting to not wanting to alienate her mother and wanting to respect her mother's rights, but also having concern for her ability to take care of herself. And then so her mother disappears, and then she's like, well, did I do the right thing? Did I not do the right thing? Like, yeah, it pained her a great deal, and I think it took a toll on her health.
At The Murder Sheet, we're all about immersive audio experiences.
That's why we love Audible. An Audible subscription gives you access to thousands of audiobook titles. We especially enjoy their robust selection of mysteries, thrillers, and true crime.
I love Audible. I've really enjoyed listening to A Wicked Snow by Greg Olson. This story is all about a CSI investigator with a dark past and a terrible family secret. When I'm listening to Audible, it plunks me right down in the middle of the story. It's so spine-tingling that I can practically feel the cold air on my skin. Audible is your one-stop destination for thrillers and mysteries. Just be prepared to get spooked in the best possible way.
Listening to audiobooks offers a wonderful respite from the day. Audible allows you to listen on the go. I love taking a walk or a drive and just getting lost in a story. My favorite audiobook on Audible so far is Presumed Innocent, the book track edition. This classic legal thriller by Scott Turow is enhanced by a gripping musical soundtrack that amplifies the story's suspense and profound emotional beats.
As a new member, you can try out Audible for free for 30 days. This is such a valuable membership, and you get access to so many new listening experiences, including podcasts, Audible originals, and Audible exclusives, like the Words Plus Music series.
Visit audible.com/msheet or text msheet to 500-500. A weight loss journey can feel like a lonely struggle, but it doesn't have to be.
For so many of us, lifestyle changes, like deciding to lose weight, adopting a nutritious diet, and taking up fun exercises, are all about putting our own health and wellness first. But it can be really hard to know where to begin, or how to keep the weight off once we've seen some progress. Quick fixes like soup diets and juice cleanses are unsustainable. There's a much better way to embark on this journey that over 200,000 people have already chosen. We're talking about the Row Body program.
Here's how it works. Row gives you access to one of the most popular weight loss shots on the market. Their Row Body program then sets up a comprehensive weight loss program tailored to your specific lifestyle, health status, and goals. In addition to the weekly shot, you get one-on-one coaching with a registered nurse that can help you adopt and stick with lifestyle changes like exercise routines and nutritious diets. It's a comprehensive program that sees participants lose 15 to 20% of their weight in a year on average. But the real benefit is that you keep that weight off. This is weight loss at its most sustainable.
With Row, the average weight loss is 15 to 20% of your weight in 1 year, in conjunction with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to row.co/msheet. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. Go to row.co/msheet. That's ro.co/msheet.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story of Judy Parker?
Yeah, so she, I never had her as a patient or anything myself, but I know from talking to her daughter that some local agencies that I've worked with did have contact with her, including, you know, just prior to her disappearance. But she's an interesting case because she, from what I learned, she had a pretty normal life, for lack of a better term. She, you know, she had kids. She'd worked for as a nurse for years and, you know, raised animals and had a pretty like regular kind of life. And then, but like a lot of women who struggle with mental illness, she had kind of a later onset. So I don't think she really developed any kind of major mental health problems until like well into her adulthood, until she was older. Essentially, she was living in Washington and ended up just kind of not taking care of herself. And her house ended up getting either foreclosed on or condemned. And she ended up homeless in Washington and then ended up coming to Oregon where her daughter lived and where she had some family. And from there was basically just, you know, kind of in and out of psychiatric facilities because she was suffering from psychosis. And at the time that she disappeared, which was in late 2016, she was living at an adult foster home in Springfield, which is the neighboring town next to Eugene. She was living at an adult foster home, and she, which was, you know, where she had a certain level of supervision, but she was allowed to come and go as she pleased. And my understanding is that she would like to kind of, she would sometimes kind of wander away and then the police would bring her back home or the staff would go and find her and bring her home, or she would end up in the hospital and then people would pick her up and take her home, that kind of thing. But so she basically walked away from the facility and she, you know, she's seen on surveillance cameras from local businesses, you know, walking down the street. And there's no, and this was like urban, you know, an urban area. It wasn't as if she was, you know, living in some isolated rural area or something. And she is basically just last seen, yeah, walking past some stores and has not been seen now for more than 6 years. And I think in her case, I don't think it's likely that she was a victim of foul play, but I think it's unlikely, but I think it's possible that she's still alive and that she's living somewhere as some, you know, just a street person, or that maybe she's in some kind of psychiatric facility somewhere. But I think that's also unlikely. I think they would have put it together who she was. It's a total mystery. I have no idea, unless the police are hiding something, and I don't get the impression that they know what happened to her. I don't get the impression that anybody does. But I mean, it may be that she is just, you know, dead in Springfield somewhere and that nobody has found her yet. At the time she went missing, it was the winter, the weather was nasty. So, I mean, it's really unlikely that she could have survived in the elements long. She was 72, I believe, when she disappeared. But it's, yeah, this is a strange thing. And this is somebody, even though I didn't personally have contact with her, I know people who did. And, you know, we see people in these kinds of situations fairly often, you know, mentally ill people that kind of fall through the cracks. And yeah, she just walked away from home and now it's been 6 years and nobody knows where she is.
I wanted to ask a sort of broader question based on that story and also just your work, both with helping, you know, assist people in mental crisis and also doing the writing at this point. So much of, I feel like these true crime stories, like mental illness may play a role, or even things like addiction may play a role in circumstances of somebody's disappearance or even death. And I mean, I guess, do you have any thoughts both as a nurse and as a writer on this subject about how we as a society can be doing a better job with assisting and supporting people with those issues so that they don't get into these dangerous situations, essentially? Obviously, it's a very broad and complicated question. So I guess I just would be curious if you have any general thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, like Oregon, you know, like, is pretty consistently ranked one of the worst states in the country, if not the worst state, for mental health and addiction treatment services. Don't get me wrong, there's good people doing good work, but mental health and addiction treatment services in Oregon are like especially dysfunctional. You know, there are a lot of people not getting the supervision that they need, and a lot of people not getting the treatment that they need. And I think you know, Judy Parker is an example of that. She didn't have a substance abuse problems, but she was elderly and she suffered from mental illness, and she definitely did not have the, I did not think she had the supervision or the support that she needed. These cases, they do often highlight bigger social problems. You know, I think like the missing and murdered Indigenous women movement, that, you know, definitely highlights some of the bigger problems in our society. Like, why are these cases ignored? Why are they buried? Why don't they get more attention? You know, with people like, you know, the Green River Killer, you know, he killed however many women. And I think, you know, the majority of his victims were sex workers. So there is this tendency, I think, historically across society and within law enforcement agencies to kind of just expect bad things to happen to people because of their lifestyle, or because of choices they've made. And then that somehow makes them less important than other people, or, you know, when they disappear or something bad happens to them, it's just kind of expected and accepted.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, one thing we've noticed in true crime is a tendency for resources, whether that's media attention, law enforcement attention, public scrutiny, tends to get allotted to a limited number of high profile cases, while lower profile cases get ignored and then are allowed to basically go unsolved.
Though on the other hand too, I mean, like with the case of Rebecca Bramall, you know, I mean, I think she suffered from mental illness. I think that was a more kind of like recent development in her life. I think she started to show major symptoms of mental illness right before she disappeared. But, you know, she came from a nice middle-class family. And, you know, and I think the reason the police didn't put more energy into her case was because there was no evidence that she'd been a victim of foul play. And from what they could determine, she had left voluntarily. So I understand the police have, you know, they have limited resources and they have to, you know, apply them where they think it's going to be the most beneficial. But, I mean, her family, these are just like, you know, normal middle class people, and they got like no assistance in figuring out what happened to her. You know, they're basically just told, well, sorry, she left willingly as far as we can tell. And so, you know, we'll make some effort to find her, but basically you're on your own.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that case. Can you give our listeners a little recap of it?
Yeah, so pull her up. She has not been missing for all that long. It's a little, sometimes she's listed as missing from Portland, and sometimes she's listed as missing from Lane County, the county where Eugene and Springfield are based. But yeah, she's been missing since 2007, so really not that long ago. But she was a Portland resident, and in the weeks leading up to her disappearance, she was starting to act really kind of erratic, like staying up all night and talking to herself, spending money recklessly and so forth. Family had kind of tried to set some limits with her because she'd been, you know, borrowing money and, you know, she was just not being very responsible. And there was some tension with the family, and her family and her boyfriend were trying to get her help. And then she just kind of vanished, stopped responding to phone calls, stopped coming to family get-togethers and that kind of thing. Her boyfriend had taken her to see a mental health service provider like right before she disappeared, but she wouldn't really cooperate with treatment. So she was, you know, reported missing to the Portland police, and they were just kind of like, well, you know, like I said, like there's no evidence of a crime. So yeah, you can report her missing, but we're not going to really do a lot about this. And then her vehicle showed up out kind of up the McKenzie Highway in a really forested area. They found her vehicle was found. But what's really like frustrating is that these like a Forest Service workers found her car and had it towed. And then the tow company basically just, even though, I mean, there was her identification and her belongings were in this vehicle, the tow company basically just sat on it for like a month and then sent the owner, Rebecca had borrowed the vehicle from a friend, they sent the owner a bill for the car being on their lot. And then they realized, wait, why was this vehicle in, you know, rural Lane County? What was she doing there? So because of, I mean, this company, you know, these tow companies, especially back then, were like notoriously sleazy and were just, you know, they ripped people off essentially. And so I think they just let this car sit on their lot so they could, you know, charge a big fee, or probably hoping that the person would just not be able to pay the fee and they would just take the vehicle. But so then they, you know, they realized that Rebecca's car that she was associated to was found in rural Lane County. So then they contacted the local sheriff's office and then they, you know, searched for her. But by then, you know, a month had gone by and she was in this like deeply forested area. So there was definitely, I mean, I think like some negligence. From what I could gather based on talking to her ex-boyfriend, I think that she probably drove out there to commit suicide and that she had spent time out there before going to hot springs and so forth. And that was just where she chose to end her life. But she was never found, partly because there was this delay with, you know, it being communicated that her vehicle was out there.
It's a very sad story. And reading it in your publication, it does seem like there wasn't a crime committed there. But obviously, she was still very much loved, and her family still deserves answers. And what can we as a society do in cases like that to help these families? Or perhaps more importantly, how can we get help to people before they become the next Rebecca Bramlett and disappear?
Those are big and difficult questions because, you know, I mean, she definitely seemed like somebody who really needed psychiatric care, but that is not easy to force on people who don't want it. And of course, respecting people's rights obviously is important, but it's also important for people to, it shouldn't have to take this, you know, somebody disappearing, dying, having some, you know, tragic fate in order to, I think that should be avoidable. I think you should be able to get people care before it reaches that level. And so, yeah, I don't know if Rebecca, if she had been committed for psychiatric reasons, if this could have been prevented. I think her family or at least her boyfriend had looked into that, but was told, you know, that she didn't meet criteria for that. But I think, you know, the mental health, you know, issues aside, I think a lot of times when families have these, you know, when somebody goes missing, a partner, a family member, a friend, there's no blueprint about what to do. I mean, basically, I mean, every family I've talked to, which, you know, isn't that many, but I think this is a pretty common theme, though, felt completely bewildered about what to do. And so, I mean, it seems like there should be some kind of, whether it's a branch of the law enforcement, like some kind of program that's based on like helping people navigate these situations. Because in every case, like, you know, I've probably spoken to, you know, maybe, I don't know, a dozen families, you know, and I've written about maybe, you know, half of them, but all of them felt like they didn't know what to do. Like they, you know, they made their reports to the police. In some cases, they talked to the media, but from there, they, you know, felt totally lost.
It's tragic. And I wonder, you know, you're reporting on these very sad cases, and how has that affected you? And like, you know, as somebody who's putting these stories out there, how do you kind of balance that with, you know, also working in a space where there can be very sad stories like that?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, I mean, I feel like I have kind of taken breaks from it just because it can be pretty overwhelming. And I think that's why families give up, or why people stop, you know, trying to figure these things out, because it's just too overwhelming. But I think that it's also, I mean, it feels to me, it's like kind of intolerable, like how, like some of these cases, it just feels like intolerable to me, like something needs to get figured out. I mean, that's how I learned about your podcast, was, you know, your coverage of the Delphi murders. And that was one of these cases where I'm like, this is just so like unacceptable, like this is intolerable, something's got to be done about this. And so I appreciate the attention that you've given that case, but I guess I think it's just important, and it's important not to stop trying.
And we appreciate that. It's like, I feel like that is an impulse that resonates with us, because oftentimes in a case it's very much we're motivated by, you know, why don't we know this? Why is no one being held accountable? You know, if it's definitely a crime, or why don't we have answers if it's maybe a bit more ambiguous? I'm curious. We've talked a bit about mental illness. We've talked a bit about, you know, marginalized people. What other themes have you picked up on in your reporting on these different cases that have changed the way that you think about, you know, crimes, or in some of these cases, you know, disappearances where there may not be a crime involved, just general themes that you're sort of unraveling as you do this work?
You know, one thing I think it's hard, and I think why it's maybe easy for police agencies to maybe be not as put as much resources into cases as you, as might be desirable, is that like you have like if you were to look at the NamUs website, for example, like there's all of these people listed as missing that you can probably that really aren't missing, that, you know, like there are people that like I've seen posters for missing people that have gone missing like multiple times, like in the past few years, that are constantly like excommunicating their families and running away or whatever, either whether it's, you know, runaway youth or people with substance abuse or mental health problems. So it's hard when, you know, you have this like this constant kind of barrage of like missing people, missing persons reports. When a lot of these people, like, yeah, they haven't in many cases, like, yeah, they you might be able to, their judgment, their ability to make good decisions might be in question, but they, you know, there's really no reason to think that they have been like taken against their will or anything. So what do you do in those situations where, yeah, there's kids run away from home, the cops can't just like pick them up and force them to go home and cooperate with their parents, or people with substance abuse problems, you can't just force them into treatment. So I think it's kind of just, you know, becomes this overwhelming thing when you're not, and there's not a lot that can be done. But at the same time, some of those people go missing and then they don't get found. And so how do you kind of tease out, you know, where something is really wrong and something really needs to be done versus these cases where, yeah, people maybe have only been missing for a short period of time and are likely to be to resurface very quickly. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, somebody contacted me recently because they were creating a website about missing people. And it was like, I'm like, this is going to be just too much because it's just this constant, like, okay, this kid was reported missing, this person was reported missing. Like, and I'm not saying that's not important to make, you know, figure out where these people are and make sure they're okay. But what I'm more interested in is like the longer term missing persons cases where, like, okay, this isn't just like a kid who ran away or somebody who wandered away. This is like, this person has been missing for like a long time and something bad happened and we need to figure out what happened.
I wanted to ask, you know, just in terms of how you go about the process of writing these, can you talk us through like a typical article that you write for the publication and like what goes into that?
Basically, like every story that I've written that like really that was profiling somebody, I took an interest in a case for whatever reason, like with Erin Beth McClary, for example, who's been missing since 1995. So she's been missing for almost 30 years. She went missing from the like the neighborhood that I grew up in. And in fact, like she was last seen at this club called the Jesco Club, a club where like they have NA meetings and AA meetings, it's like a sober living club. People can come there and drink coffee and play pool and attend meetings and stuff. And so the last place she was seen was at the Jesco Club. And I've, you know, been there a number of times over the years responding to calls. In the early 90s, there was this like punk rock venue called Icky's Tea House, which was right next to the Jesco Club. Icky's Tea House hasn't been around for years, but it was around at the time that she went missing. And I was, you know, a kid going to like punk rock shows during that time. And I thought, well, I was like, oh, that's like a trip, you know, that I could have encountered this woman maybe. I mean, she was older than me. And but around Icky Sea House and the Jesco Club, there was always a lot of like, you know, kind of interesting riffraff, you know. And so it's like, it felt kind of close to home to me because it's the neighborhood I grew up in and in an area I frequented. But she struggled with addiction issues and she had worked as a prostitute. She's been missing for almost 30 years. I think there's basically no chance that she's still alive. And I think, unfortunately, something probably really terrible happened to her. But I found online, so I took an interest in her case for, you know, various reasons. And I found somebody had posted stuff on a genealogy website, some pictures of her and, you know, references to her. And so I contacted them. It turned out it was with her niece who was close to her when she was growing up. And so through her niece, I was able to get in touch with other family members and kind of just went from there. And that's kind of how every whenever I've written about somebody, it's kind of played out like that. Like I've taken an interest in a case for whatever reason, and then I've been able to track somebody down on Facebook or however, and I reach out to them and say, hey, would you be willing to talk to me? And in most cases, they say yes, and then we, you know, end up talking.
And then we just wanted to ask, are there any other cases or themes that you wanted to spotlight?
Are you familiar at all with the case of Michaela Bolly?
Why don't you tell us about it?
This is not a girl who's missing from Oregon. She's missing from Yorkton, Saskatchewan, Canada. She's been missing she's been missing since 2016. So she was 16 when she disappeared. And so she would be 22 or 23. But I find her case really bothersome. And it's really bothersome that so much time has gone by. And from what I can tell, I mean, again, I don't know what the police know. Really, but I mean, this it seems like a real, a true mystery. I get the impression that this nobody knows what happened to this girl, but whatever happened, is, I think, is really bad. So on the day that she went missing, she had gone to school and had left school and gone to this like restaurant that was next to like a bus station, like basically their equivalent of like the Greyhound bus. And she sent her friends some kind of cryptic messages saying like, I might need your help. And but then she'd gone back to school and then she'd gone back to this restaurant and her, you'd have to look it up to get the whole, you know, sequence of events. And there's plenty of information about it on the internet. But so she basically, what she was kind of demonstrating that she was having some apprehension about something and that she was kind of on the fence about doing something. And, you know, she'd done other strange things that day. She'd approached a random woman at this restaurant and asked if she gave that woman some money, if she would rent her a motel room, because as a minor, she couldn't rent a motel room. And of course, this woman was like, no. But her behavior the day of her disappearance was pretty strange. And where she was last seen, there wasn't a lot of like video surveillance. From what I can gather, I mean, this girl, there's some sources that say that she had self-esteem problems and stuff, but she seemed like a pretty regular kid. It didn't seem like she had a really troubled home life. It seemed like she, you know, did well in school and had a good social life and that kind of thing. But all the information I've read suggests that she probably got lured into meeting somebody that she had gotten romantically involved with online through these, you know, various apps. I think she was probably abducted by somebody who, yeah, lured her into meeting with him. But it's been 6-7 years now, and she has just vanished, and nobody knows where she is.
That sounds like a really chilling case in terms of some of her bizarre behavior beforehand, and the possibility that this child was like lured away by, you know, somebody she met online.
Yeah, it's a really bothersome case, and it's sad because you can, based on her behavior, I mean, it seems like there was some part of her that was telling her not to follow through with this, where she was leaving school and coming back and texting friends, kind of cryptic messages and stuff. There was some part of her that was like wondering if it was really a good idea. But then, you know, ultimately it seems like she followed through with meeting this person, and, you know, and who knows what happened from there. I think it's a good possibility that she's still alive, but I think, you know, probably really bad things have happened. Definitely a case I would recommend people dig into.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Are you familiar at all with Megan Good and the Charlie Project?
Yes. I think that site a lot, looking up different cases. I think we've cited them in an episode about a woman who went missing in Massachusetts. It was the 70s. She was hitchhiking. So unfortunately, like, the possibilities are endless about, you know, something bad happening. I mean, obviously it was a different culture back then, so hitchhiking was much more prominent. But the Charlie Project had some helpful information about, you know, the circumstances, what she was wearing, things like that.
The resources about missing people they're not very good. You know, even NamUs, it's just, they really lack useful information. You know, the Charlie Project, which is, you know, run basically by, you know, one person who is on the autism spectrum and has this like amazing ability to like collect and categorize information, is the most comprehensive resource about missing people in this country. I think that the Charlie Project is incredible, but it's also like really kind of strange that like just one person who's not a police officer or anything like that is the, you know, the one who's really tracking these cases and compiling information about them more than anyone, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it's like really impressive that she does that and has been, you know, it's been such an incredible resource to people interested in unsolved disappearances. But as you said, like, you know, as a country, we can't, you know, put some resources toward having like a government body do that. Maybe it would, you know, maybe it would result in more action on some of these cases. I just hate the idea that some cases get forgotten. And I totally understand that like law enforcement has limited resources, and they, you know, in some cases, it's if there's no evidence, what are we going to do, you know, with a certain disappearance. But at the same time, it's just really depressing because, like, those are people too. And they're, you know, people who cared about them deserve answers.
Right. I think it's really strange and really bothersome, though. I mean, I do understand it on some level, but, like, just the lack of information about some of these people, because even if the family or police have kind of given up on figuring out what happened, or they know, you know, something bad happened and they just want to move on or whatever, like, I would think that there'd be some, like, more effort to sort of, like, preserve the memory of some of these people. Like, I'm looking at the Charlie Project website right now. There's this girl named Deborah Tomlinson. Been missing since 1973. Basically says that she went hitchhiking with a friend and was never seen again. Like, I'm like, is that really all the only information that we have about this girl? You know, like, she disappeared like 40 years ago. Like, I would think that there would be some, even if there's no hope in figuring out what happened to her, some, like, effort to, I don't know, I mean, put some information about her out there to, like, you know, who was this person? Like, that she should be honored in some way.
The worst thing is, and I'm sure you've had situations similar to this, but when you reach out to a law enforcement agency who's listed as the lead of the investigation on something like Namus or the Charlie Project, and they don't have any idea what you're talking about when you bring up the case.
Totally.
And it's like, oh man, like, you're the last hope. And, you know, if the agency of record is not even paying attention to this, then, you know, that means nobody is, basically, unfortunately, like, on the law enforcement side.
Yeah, one time I did a records request, and I paid like $150 or something for, like, records from the sheriff's office, thinking I was going to get this, like, you know, box of documents or something. And I literally got like one piece of paper in the mail that provided like no useful information at all. It was like the worst, like, use of money ever. And don't get me wrong, I like the local sheriff's office just fine, but it was quite disappointing.
That is disappointing. Jeez. Yeah, that's always a lottery, because it's like a roulette wheel, because you're hoping that it has something of value, but there's always the possibility that it's going to just basically be, here's the name of the person.
Yeah. I like the Charlie Project because it's so comprehensive, but I think it's going to, unfortunately, like, fall on sort of amateur kind of people like ourselves to preserve the memory of some of these people and to really, like, get information about them out there. I think that's just how it's going to be.
I guess I feel like we all sort of fill a bit of a void left by not really law enforcement, but more of the traditional in-depth local newspapers that used to be able to do more, like, intensive coverage of local cases that maybe do not have the staff to be able to do that, you know, not across the board. Some local newspapers do that all the time, but many don't anymore. And I feel like that's where we can, you know, use these stories to raise awareness and say, no, this is going on. You need to be paying attention.
Right.
But that's my take anyways. Listen, this has been delightful. I feel like you're preaching to the choir with us, and this has been really enjoyable for us to chat with you. I wanted to ask you, I'm going to ask you, like, anything we didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about, and then where can people check out this publication?
Yeah, it's another, like, you know, I don't have any kind of social media presence or anything, so I could definitely be better about, you know, promoting stuff. But, you know, if you do a search of Out From the Void online, I mean, you'll find some of my articles. If you go to the Eugene Weekly site and look up Out From the Void, you'll find some of my articles. If you email me at outfromthevoid@yahoo.com, if you want me to, I'll send you articles. I'll send you PDFs. I'll send you links. I'll even, you know, mail stuff to you if you are, interested in the publication. And maybe at some point, you know, I've talked to some friends about creating a website that, you know, could maybe, you know, feature some of my own articles, but also more just, you know, profiles on some of these local cases that interest me. And so hopefully I'll do that at some point. But right now, really, I mean, you can find the information looking it up online, or you can email me at outfromthevoid@yahoo.com, and I'd be happy to send you stuff.
I just want to ask you also behind the scenes, how did you find out about us? You were just interested in the Delphi case?
Yeah, I think I listened to that other podcast. What was it, like, Down the Hill?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I listened to that, and I think I just did a search, looking for updates on the Delphi case, you know, because I was excited when Richard Allen was arrested. Mm-hmm. And then, just through doing like an internet search or whatever, found your podcast. And then, you know, I've been listening to it since.
Awesome. We really appreciate that. It's been interesting to cover the Delphi case because you do learn getting more into the investigation. There's a lot of stuff, you know, public doesn't even know about that you get to kind of, you know, people should take in, you know, it's just kind of like things are not always as they seem in true crime.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like a case where, I mean, kind of like the Michaela Bolli case. I personally think that, you know, a lot of times there's a tendency for people to want things to be more like exotic than they are. Whereas I think a lot of times things tend to be more straightforward. But I feel like with the Delphi case, and this is just, sorry if you don't, obviously we have covered this a lot, you know a lot more about it than I do, but I feel like it's going to reveal some really sinister things. That's kind of how I feel about the Michaela Bolli case. I think it's going to, like, if we ever figure out what happened, it's going to reveal some really nefarious things.
I think it's fair to say that we both agree with you on that. I mean, and our unofficial motto is like, true crime is usually more boring than it sounds. And like, everybody wants everything to be a serial killer because that's more interesting, but not everything is a serial killer, right? But certain cases do have surprises where you are like, wow, you know, that's horrifying and maybe worse than the boring answer for sure.
Right.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Brenton. This has been great.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
No, you did great. You're awesome. We'd like to thank Brenton for sharing his insights with us.
Reach out to him at outfromthevoid@yahoo.com and take a look at Out from the Void if you can. It's a thoughtful and thorough publication. Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.